are so far. Okay, and if you've missed them, and you know, if we go with the missed the lectures, we've actually had five or six sessions. We've got it on six audio cassettes, so if you missed any of the lectures, or if you just like to catch up, if we go with a seminary, you're probably going to want to go back over that so you can pass the test and do the assignments, do the reading and all. But what we looked at was kind of an intro to apologetics, and we dealt with the issue of epistemology. Okay, and so for the intro, we covered like the biblical basis of apologetics. We defined apologetics. We talked about the different branches of apologetics. We refuted fideism. Somebody tell me what fideism is?
You don't need to defend the faith.
Right. The idea, you just believe. Faith and reason don't mix. You don't need to defend the faith. You just believe by a leap of blind faith. And that showed that to be non-scriptural. Epistemology. What is epistemology?
Study of knowledge.
Right. It's the philosophical study of knowledge, the theory of knowledge. So we dealt with the issues of truth and knowledge. What's wrong if somebody tells you there is no absolute truth?
Yeah,
it's a self-refuting statement. If that statement is true, it would be an absolute truth. So it can't be true. And what's wrong with the statement, man cannot know truth?
We know that it cannot know it, so we know it.
Yeah, it's also self-refuting, because if man cannot know, if that statement is true, then man could at least know something, and that is that man cannot know. So whatever way you look at it, there is absolute truth and man can know it. And that opens the door for us to defend the Christian faith. So now for the next 5 or 6 weeks, we're going to be talking about philosophical apologetics. And philosophical apologetics deals with arguing for Christianity using reason, okay? In other words, we're not going to look at history, that's historical apologetics. We'll look a little bit at science, but we'll save most of it for a series we're going to do on scientific apologetics, creation science. But right now, we'll deal with philosophical apologetics or rational apologetics. Today we're going to start talking about the failure of atheism. We'll also talk about the failure of other non-theistic worldviews. A worldview is the way you view reality, and theism is the way of viewing reality that acknowledges the existence of a personal God. So there's Christian theism, Islamic theism, and Jewish theism, okay? And so we'll show that not only does atheism, the belief there is no God, fail, but all of the non-theistic worldviews like pantheism, the New Age belief that God is the universe, man is God, God is an impersonal force, God is an it, not a personal being, that all these other worldviews fail. We'll also talk about the problem of evil. We'll probably talk about the problem of evil before, since it's the major atheistic argument. We'll probably talk about that before we even get to the non-theistic worldviews. We'll try to refute moral relativism. We'll try to defend the possibility of miracles Now, because we say that miracles are possible, we're not saying that some guy that just claimed to have been transported to heaven last week, that automatically we're giving him the stamp of approval. But we're talking about, are miracles possible? Is it possible that God the Father really raised Jesus from the dead? Is it really possible that Jesus gave sight to the blind? Okay? So when we defend the possibility of miracles, then you still have to look, say, okay, philosophically miracles are possible, then you still have to look at the historical data to see if, in fact, the miracle actually occurred. We'll do that when we get to historical apologetics. But the main thing we'll be studying, the main topic in philosophical apologetics, are the arguments for God's existence or evidence for God's existence. Okay? So it's these six different things that we'll be talking about. And today we're going to start with the failure of atheism. Do you have any comments or questions either right now or as we go along? Feel free to bring them up. Yeah?
Well, this one probably doesn't really pertain to it. I was going to purchase some manuscripts from my old authors, my church fathers.
Mm-hmm.
What do you feel about the author of Philo, of Alexander?
From Alexander, it's been asked.
Well, he's... He was Neoplatonic, and now, if I remember right, he was considered a Jewish philosopher. And though some of his ideas may have overlapped with Gnostic-type thinking because of their Neoplatonic roots. So, in other words, I think we can learn a lot from him. Now, are you buying it? I know you read in other languages. Are you buying it in English?
No, it's going to be the original Greek version. I thought that kind of has, because the internet quarters are all, unbloody. So, I just don't want to make that investment.
The thing is, now, if you wanted the English version, I'm not sure if it has the Greek text with it. I think you can get it for about $10, nice hardbound through Christian book distributors. And you can either go through the internet or through mail. At the same time, I don't think that has the Greek text. And if you want just the Greek text, or if you want the Greek text plus the English, there might not be anything, inexpensive way to get it. But it is definitely a worthwhile read. But what you have is a great thinker who comes out of Jewish thought, but it was, I believe, Neoplatonic in his thought. So he accepted a lot of Plato's type thinking. So he'd kind of be kind of like what Augustine was to Christianity, a Christian Platonist, whereas Aquinas was a Christian Aristotelian. And Moses Maimonides was a Jewish, came about the 12th century A.D., 11th, 12th century A.D., effectively the 11th century A.D. Moses Maimonides was a Jewish Aristotelian. Philo was more of a Jewish, an ancient Jewish Neoplatonist. And just because he was writing so far back, contemporary of the early church, that in itself gives it a whole slew of worth. Now I think the best investments, I wish the Institute had the funds, because for only $300 through CBD, you can get all the church fathers, which starts with the apostolic fathers, the pupils of the apostles who led the early church, and goes straight through... just passed the Council of Nicaea.
Is that like 304 individuals?
It's I think it's 38 volumes long. So for basically it's worth about $1,200, but most Christians don't care much for thinking, so and for our heritage, so they can, they've got all these sets left, so they're trying to sell them for $300 a piece. So yeah, we had the institute. If we had our own office space and had our own library, then it'd be worthwhile to pick them up.
It would be for you. I mean, do you own those?
No. And you can currently, you can tap into them on the internet and just read them for nothing, but it, for me, that's not the same.
No, it's not the same, especially when you're doing comparative
research. Yeah.
You need to look it up in the original and always go to your search engine.
Yeah, and then, you know, and you could, we take a drive to Tacoma and go to Northwest Baptist Seminary Library, but it's just not the same of having access to it all the time. It's one of those sets that if we had a library, it would be a set where this would be some of the reference stuff that you can't check out, but you can sit down and work with it in the library all the time, and so it's definitely something we're gonna have to pick up someday. We're hoping if we get the extension to get at least office space and library space downtown somewhere. And probably be a real dive area. I mean, just to get that, for us to afford it, we'd have to be pretty low budget. But whatever the case, they got some pretty good deals too out in town because you know, Bremerton as a city died in the not too distant past. So, whatever the case, but Philo's got some pretty interesting stuff, and he's a brilliant thinker. Failure of atheistic arguments. First, we have to define atheism. Atheism is basically the positive belief. By positive, I mean atheists claim that they just lack belief in God. So the atheist claims, I'm not claiming any belief, any positive belief. I just lack belief in God, so I don't have to prove anything. Burden of proof is on you. That's the way the atheist will put it. But in actuality, atheism historically comes from the Greek word theos and the Greek prefix a, which means no God. So atheism historically has been the belief that there is no God, which means it's its own worldview. It's not just a rejection of everybody else's worldview, it's its own worldview. Even Michael Martin tries to argue that he doesn't have to prove anything. And, you know, they try to make it easier for atheists. In actuality, just the fact that an atheist, as Cornelius Van Til pointed out, just the fact that an atheist can argue and reason that God doesn't exist implies that God does exist. It's an argument for God's existence. Because just the fact that the atheist believes in the validity of human reason implies that there's a reasonable cause, a rational cause for our existence. If all that exists is mere molecules and motions, like most atheist claim, then basically human reason wouldn't be, the statement there is no God would be just as meaningless as the statement there is a God. There would be no meaning, no reason to anything. But whatever the case, atheism has now been redefined. Guys like Michael Martin in his book, Atheism, Philosophical Justification, he tries to redefine atheism. But historically, atheism is the belief that God definitely does not exist.
So it's mainly a worldview thing. Like,
yeah.
You put on your atheism glasses.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So if there is no God, you don't have to believe that there is no God. There is no God, it's just a lack of belief.
They're claiming that it's just a lack of belief in God, but in actuality, that's what agnosticism has been historically.
Well,
show you where they.
That's why you'll never see the evolutionist who holds hard to the theory of survival of the fittest won't go out and start killing people because he knows that there's laws. But why would he follow laws if there's true survival?
And I don't remember if it was one of the Huxleys. There was an evolutionist who said that if we're consistent with our views, when a relative dies, we should just pick up his body and throw it in the nearest dumpster.
Yeah.
And but then, you know, when that guy's loved one died, he probably had a funeral. So it's like they're wearing their worldview glasses, where they see everything purple, and they're atheist, but then all of a sudden they get a green situation, a Christian situation, a guy dies, and they take off the glasses and they put on the green glasses, but they pretend that they never took the purple glasses off. Francis Schaeffer pointed out, no one can live consistently with a non-Christian worldview. I'll give you just a little example of what I'm getting at. When Bertrand Russell debated Frederick Copleston, the great Jesuit philosopher, Jesuit priest who wrote the 9-volume set of History of Philosophy, when they debated back in the 1940s, early in that debate, Copleston asked Russell, and Russell was the leading atheist of his day. Michael Martin now is the most famous atheist of our day, on American soil, that is. I would say Anthony Flew is worldwide. But Bertrand Russell admitted that technically he really wasn't an atheist, he was an agnostic. See, because the definition of an agnostic is a person who holds the belief that man cannot know if God exists. And by the way, that's strong or hard agnosticism. Soft agnosticism is the belief that man doesn't know if God exists. In other words, soft agnosticism says, look, no one's ever really proven that God exists. However, it's possible that someday we might receive proof that God does exist. Well, I don't really have a philosophical problem with soft agnostics, because they're saying it's possible that God exists. So basically, I would get right into the witnessing mode or presenting historical evidences, because they're open to the possibility of God's existence. A hard agnostic says, well, even if God exists, man cannot know God. We cannot know if that he exists, we cannot know him. Okay? So when atheists say that when they redefine atheism as the lack of belief in God, that's what has historically been called agnosticism. Gnosis means, the Greek word for knowledge, means no knowledge. No knowledge of God is what the agnostic claims. The atheist is supposed to claim that there's no God. What is being veiled between the 1940s and the year 2001? In fact, I would say between the 1940s and the early 1990s. What is being veiled, what is being hidden there, is the total annihilation of the atheistic worldview in philosophical debates. Russell saw it as early as in the 1940s, so that he no longer wanted to call himself an atheist, at least not in the presence of a great thinking Christian philosopher, because he did not want to be torn to shreds. And so he basically said, no, I'm just an agnostic. I lack belief in God. I question whether man can know that God exists. I don't believe that God's non-existence has been proven. Because we're going to see that's a pretty tough thing to claim. So basically what happened was atheism was defeated in the last century, and rather than admit defeat, they changed, they jumped from the atheist camp to the agnostic camp, and redefined agnosticism so they can still call themselves atheists and claim that there was never any defeat.
And what seems to be the pattern is maybe 200 years from now, the pattern would be, well, now they're theists, but now they're just judging which God is going to be worshipped.
You know, and it's really interesting because actually with postmodernism, it opens the door to ancient myths. And I do think 21st century apologetics is going to have to start dealing with which God is the true God rather than does God exist. It's really interesting, too. Paul Herrick, a friend of mine, a Christian philosopher that teaches philosophy at Shoreline Community College, I listened to one of his lectures the other day on audio cassette, and he said that the five, in his college, the five leading challenges to Christianity that he finds among his students are scientific naturalism, which is atheism, all dressed up in scientific knowledge and evolutionary theory, Marxism, still popular among college students, postmodernism, we talked a lot about that already, and then the other two are actually babies of postmodernism, because postmodernism says there's no worldview that is true, all worldviews are myths or stories. Well, because of that, postmodernism has spun off, and two other challenges to Christianity that are leading challenges that Dr. Herrick sees on his campus there, and probably I would say the rampant throughout the country, are goddess worship or goddess religion, basically the return of witchcraft, Wicca, mankind has that mankind, it supposedly was a paradise at one time, was matriarchal, where females ruled, and it was a worship the earth goddess, and everything was great. And then mankind took over, became a patriarchal society, and we've had nothing but wars and horrible things since then. And so the radical women's livers are becoming witches, and are basically arguing that we should turn the world over, the reins of the world over to the world, and there's lots of crazy jokes, the comebacks to that. I don't want to bring up any of them, but this is becoming more and more popular. I've even heard from an atheist sociology professor that interviewed me on his television program that teaches at Evergreen State College, that he catches a lot of flack from the female teachers, the professors there, because most of them are Wiccan, and because he was rescued by Christians. I think he lived in El Salvador, I believe. It was either Nicaragua or El Salvador. I think it was El Salvador, but he was rescued by the Christians from the communists, the Marxists, even though he wasn't a Christian, and they knew he wasn't a Christian. So even though he doesn't believe like Christians believe, he respects them. And just because he respects Christians, the Wiccan teachers over there, you know, behind his back are trying to get him fired and everything. And so that's becoming very prevalent. And then the fifth challenge to Christianity that Paul Herrick sees is Afrocentrism, and which is basically the view, another postmodern view, that the blacks from Africa were really the founders of the great philosophy, Western philosophy and Western civilization, and that it has been a European conspiracy to enslave the blacks and to rewrite history. So every great invention, every great every great idea, philosophical idea, can be traced back ultimately to black African thinkers. Now, it sounds like that's foolishness. Yeah, but the postmodern view of history is the reader determines, the reader and his community and his or her community determines what history really means, even more than the writer of history, because ultimately there is no absolute truth. And so that's some of the kind of garbage that's coming out. So out of this, I think neo-paganism is going to take a quantum leap.
Then you have to talk about the other races, because I got this going up a lot. It's a black and white thing for racism, and it's never really been that way for me, because I perceive racism just as much as a black Christian.
I'm an Indian.
You're Mayan and you're Aztecs, you know, who also were great thinkers. But of course their civilization died out for one reason or another. It's always focused on one.
The thing too that Paul Herrick pointed out was the thing that these five worldviews all have in common is a hatred of Western civilization as it was influenced by Christianity. So that the common thread there is that hatred of Christianity. But basically what I'm getting at is the...
Now, these things, those philosophies are mostly American philosophies. How does Europe or Asia, are they... Is this just something localized in American philosophy?
Postmodernism is actually stronger in Europe than it is here in America. Whereas Marxism itself, it depends what somebody... Marxist communism is has been almost totally rejected in Europe, and we're usually behind Europe. However, I would say Gramscian communism, which is the same Marxist goals, but instead you achieve it through... I would classify President Clinton as a Gramscian communist. All liberals, basically you want big government to solve all your problems, but you move to big government not through radical revolution, but instead through evolution, by gradually changing society, by taking over key positions in media, politics, education,
infiltration.
Yeah, infiltration, exactly. And you know, under that definition, communism is alive and well, but it's not Marxism. Marxism, you know, revolution is essential to it. And so that's why the guys in the 60s that were protesting on college campuses, you know, they shaved their beards off, they took a bath, they brushed their teeth, they threw on three-piece suits, and now they're Gramscian communists and sitting in high places and holding high political offices in America.
Something's got to give, and eventually, you know, that too will fail. And it might fail in revolution.
Well, I think, though, communists, whether they're the Gramscian or the Marxist type, all want, before, okay, they all want this one world government, okay? And I'll keep in mind, I don't want to get off the subject too much, but in Marxism, when you have the revolution, the working class revolts, and the working class rules. You have a dictatorship of the proletariat. The working class started a dictatorship until all the countries on earth have dictatorships headed by the working class, and then they all unite and you have a classless society. Okay? Lenin was a Marxist, but he changed a few things of Marxist thought so that Lenin's brand of communism said that working class people are good at working, they're not real good at ruling. So you need professional revolutionaries to head the dictatorship, and then when all the countries have been taken, or the world have been taken over, then you enter into this classless society. But whatever the case, this and there are some times when communists like Gorbachev and Marx himself used communism and socialism synonymously. Technically, in Marxist terms, communism meant the classless society, the end stage, and socialism was the dictatorship state. That's why it was the USSR. The Soviet, I mean the socialistic, the word socialism was used rather than communism. So basically, socialists, communists, they all want big government, and they eventually want big government on a global scale.
Like the People's Republic of China.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, Nazism, often people refer to it as being on the right. It's not on the right. It's still on the left, because Nazism means National Socialist. So, I mean, they're in the same camp. They're just a different twist than the communist. But basically what I'm getting at is what keeps getting bigger and bigger, and don't expect it to get any smaller, is the the idea that we need big government to solve all our problems, that big government is God, and we need a one world government of unlimited power to do all our thinking for us.
But yeah, I think it's still relevant because Marxism itself is an atheistic political institution, right?
Mm-hmm.
So was it forced atheism, I guess you can call it? Take over and force the people to rely on the government?
And I think if anything, what's being found out about the communism of the Gramscian and... although Gramsci can bend, but the communism of Marx is, you know, just that heavy atheistic thrust. Gramsci said, "Look, Marx, you don't understand. I'm an Italian. I'm from Italy. Our religion is a lot more important than you think. The people. I'm an atheist like you, Marx." Gramsci would say, "But the people aren't going to give up their religion."
That's why Marx kept the churches as a tool. Religion should be a tool.
No, the Gramsci kept the churches as a tool.
Well, the East Orthodox Church. That's why they're still around.
That was just Russia's decision, but it's still state-operated churches. Gramsci, the difference would be when they take over, the Soviet Union allowed state-operated churches to proclaim a watered-down gospel, which was no gospel at all, because it offered no threat to them. Just like in China, the state church offers no threat to them. But with Gramsci, what you do is before you even take over a country, instead of speaking against the church, you sneak into the church and you get ordained a priest, and then you go on. So a liberation theology is not only a product of postmodernism, it's also a product of Gramscian communism, where you take over the leadership of the church in, like as was done in Nicaragua. And so that, you know, the Pope could speak out against liberation theology, which turns Jesus into the greatest Marxist revolutionary who ever lived, and claims that salvation, there's no spiritual salvation, it's salvation of the poor through big government, through communist government. You know, so Gramsci, instead of slamming government as the opium of the people, it was like you befriend it and use it and take it over. So it was a tool to get to power. Whereas in communism, it's your enemy, and then when you come to power, you defeat your enemy, and then you set up a puppet, a false church, to make the people feel like their needs are being, spiritual needs are being met.
Would you say atheism's a big threat to Christianity today still? Or it looks to be watered down itself?
Atheism's pretty much been defeated, but now agnosticism now calls itself atheism. And though I would say that that's a, I'd say yes and no. Yes, it's a big threat in that it causes a lot of people to reject Christianity. But no, it's not a big threat in that it's in the sense that it's going to replace Christianity. In other words, it has the power to take a person who already doesn't want to bow before God. It gives the person the excuses to reject God because there's so much evidence against God. But then you can't live as an atheist, and so it's kind of a halfway house between Christianity and Eastern mysticism or New Age pantheism. So in other words, atheism is in much worse shape today in America or in Europe than Christianity is.
Yeah,
Christianity is in pretty bad shape too. But atheism, whatever what's left of atheism, there's enough of it left to offer a stumbling block to Christianity. But once somebody falls into its grip isn't strong enough to hold on to them. They eventually, very few people go the Michael Martin route and will stay atheist till the day they die. Most now, you know, Carl Sagan was moving. That was the whole science fiction bent of Carl Sagan, was the fact that, you know, he capitalized the sea of cosmos. And he was looking to search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Yeah, he even personalized nature.
Yeah.
I mean, nature controls this. You know, the man who doesn't believe in a God,
yep,
is saying that yet nature controls you.
One of the last things he said was that we were mistaken. We need to get religion back into the schools.
Yep.
Now, he wasn't saying we need to get prayer and Christianity back in the schools. He's saying we need to get, and then he talked about if we don't get people to worship the earth, we're going to blow this planet up. So Carl Sagan was rapidly moving from his atheism towards New Age pantheism. So the atheistic attacks against Christianity have to be answered. But people who fall prey to the atheistic attacks to Christianity usually don't end up in atheism for too long. They usually end up in more of a pantheistic type belief system.
Well, the thing is, it just doesn't allow you to do anything. You just get to stay the same way that you are. And that in itself causes a person to think that this is worthless.
Yeah, transcendence is lost.
Carl Sagan's cancer that accelerated his belief. He got cancer. He's like, oh man. And then you hear all the news. He's always hanging out with the New Agers and the press conferences, and his guru was there. And all that.
Actually, you could
end up the same way. But it,
what you could even you can find it in the 1960s. Martin he's still the secular humanist kind of atheist, and they are very anti-New Age. They will sit down with Christians and tell jokes about the New Agers, about how weird they are. Even though politically speaking, they have much more in common. They want a one-world government. Humanist Manifesto is number one and two. A one-world socialistic government.
So it seems like the atheist actual movement is more retreat. Kind of, it's more political.
It's not so much retreat as it is... It's kind of like if gladiators are battling it out, and one of the gladiators is an atheist, okay? He's lost one arm, both his legs, he's bleeding to death, he's dropped his sword, and he's reaching for his sword, and he's saying, if I can just, you know, and as other gladiators are coming in for the kill, he's saying, if I could just grab that sword, I can win this thing. So it's not like atheism is in retreat. Actually, atheism is dead because now atheism is really agnosticism in disguise. It's agnosticism, but it should be in retreat. Of course, they don't have any legs to run with. But they just—I mean—they're in denial, big time. Deep down inside, it bothers them that they're losing their professorships. That when you get new professors are being hired on, no longer are they hiring these atheists. Very few guys are like Doug Jessup, out of North Carolina. He was the moderator for one of the debates I had, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill campus. Very few young philosophers being hired now on major universities are atheists. Most of them tend to be from the New Age bent, or at least they're at least not modernistic atheists. They're postmodern atheists, which are buddy buddy with the New Agers. And postmodern atheist is an atheist who, since there really is no truth, embraces myths, and that's got nothing in common with the traditional atheists of America and Europe. I mean, they slam Christianity. The traditional atheists, the modernistic atheists, slam Christianity because it was just another myth, they said. Well, now the new atheists still slam Christianity, but they embrace the ancient myths. So, what's wrong with this picture? It's like Christianity is wrong because it was one of those myths. And now all of a sudden, well, Christianity is wrong. What we need is a myth. So,
wouldn't that be admitting that we're right in itself?
I think not necessarily admitting that we're right, but admitting that they were wrong.
Yes.
If they would just face it. But again, they're in denial. That's why I say apologetics right now is going on college campuses and debating atheists. or maybe even debating New Agers. Apologetics 20 years from now might be casting demons out of people. It might be power encounters rather than rational argumentation. Postmodernism certainly opens the way because it argues that it throws out right rational argumentation and replaces it with power narratives. And
and
whoever tells the most persuasive story, the most powerful story, and
it's a silver tongue.
Yeah. So it's really kind of scary to say the least. Okay, so basically atheism is the belief that God doesn't exist. Agnosticism is just the lack of belief in God or the belief that man cannot know if God exists. Now, the hard form of agnosticism and atheism are both actually self-refuting. Atheism, to definitely know that God does not exist, you would have to have the attributes of God. You would have to be all-knowing to be able to prove that God doesn't exist either in the physical realm or the spiritual realm, just in case the spiritual realm does exist. Okay. Now, in other words, let's say that... let's say that there's an infinite number of white ping pong balls, if that were possible, which it's not, but let's say there's an infinite number of white ping pong balls. But Carlito claims that he found the one red ping pong ball. And then it got mixed up with the other white ping pong balls, okay? For me to say there is no red ping pong ball, that implies omniscience. That implies that I'm all-knowing. That I searched the infinite number of white ping pong balls and found that there is no red ping pong ball. That's what the atheist is claiming. You would have to be God to disprove the existence of God.
Aren't the sequence of the same thing? I mean, to say there's something absolutely not there or there, for that matter, then you'd have to be God. Because
it requires the universe.
Clark is another example. Arthur C. Clarke of the atheist slash agnostic slash pantheist. You know, I mean, they just can't stay. You know, that's why Paul said you reject the existence of the true God, Romans 1, you end up bowing down before statues of four-legged creatures. Atheism is just a halfway house into paganism. In the end, it's either Christianity or paganism. You know, these guys say, I'm too educated to worship, to believe in myths that God rose Jesus from the dead and that God exists. I'm a scientific man. And so 20 years later, the guy's bowing down before a rock. But he was too educated to be a Christian. And, you know, that's why Paul says, professing to be wise, they become fools. And, whatever the case, so atheism is self-refuting. So to say, there is no red ping pong ball. But how do you know? It's impossible to examine all the white ping pong balls. Now, Carlito, would he be refuting himself, or would he be contradictory, incoherent to say that the red ping pong ball exists? No. Because he's claiming that I've had an experience of the red ping pong ball. So when a Christian says, I know God exists, I haven't read Aquinas, or I haven't read Augustine, and haven't read Bonaventure, haven't read William Paley's work or Blaise Pascal, but I know that God exists because I've experienced him. Now, maybe the person hallucinated, who knows, but there's nothing incoherent or contradictory about that statement. So if a guy says, I know that God exists because I've experienced him, or I know there's a red ping pong ball because I've experienced it, you know, that is a rational claim. And you might even be able to prove that. You might go and take this atheist and start looking through the white ping pong balls for 50 years and then both die, never finding the red ping pong ball again. But it doesn't make the claim that you experienced the red ping pong ball any less coherent. So, but the atheist claim there is no red ping pong ball, with one, I'll give the atheist one exception. If you could prove that the concept of a personal God is self-contradictory, self-refuting, then, like in other words, if it were logically impossible for a red ping pong ball to exist, then you could prove it without even looking at the white ping pong balls. But you see, every attempt for the atheist to do that has failed, and it has failed miserably, and Bertrand Russell knew that as early as the 1940s. Michael Martin and company admit that, but they don't admit that they're agnostics. They still try to claim to be atheists. They should be more honest and admit they're agnostics. In other words, when the atheist...